Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Appreciate the opportunity to come up to Cornell again and have a chance to look into this subject. I'm afraid I never did in my 4 years here quite get used to the weather in this area. And worse than that, just a little over 2 weeks ago, I was sitting by the Dead Sea having a picnic lunch, and the temperature was slightly above 60 degrees and the sun was beating down fiercely. But we're inside now and it's fairly warm, so we'll see if we can proceed to the dark reaches of outer space and look into the questions of the origin of the universe. The subject this evening, the origin of the universe, is certainly an area where man has, as far back as we can know anything about man, been interested. Even in very ancient times, we find people telling us things about the origin of what exists. We would like to look this evening at some of the ancient cosmologies that have been proposed, coming to us from far back in history. We'd like to look actually at three of these as sort of a representative sample of ancient cosmology. The first one we'd like to look at is one of the cosmologies of the Hindus, the so-called Hindu Vedic hymn of creation. This is one of the most sophisticated of the many accounts of creation given in the Hindu scriptures. It comes from the Rig Veda, book 10, number 129. The translation of this passage from Sanskrit into English has been done by a number of people with slightly different results. We'd like to look briefly at Griffith's translation. I'll read it to you, and you'll get a little bit of an idea what this Hindu Vedic hymn of creation has to say. Then was not non-existent, nor existent. There was no realm of air, no sky beyond it. What covered in, and where? What gave shelter? Was water there, unfathomed depth of water? Death was not then, nor was aught immortal. No sign was there, the days and nights divider. That one thing, breathless, breathed by its own nature. Apart from it was nothing whatsoever. Darkness there was. At first concealed in darkness, this all was indiscriminated chaos. All that existed then was void and formless. By the great power of warmth was born that unit. Thereafter arose desire in the beginning. Desire is a primal seed and germ of spirit. Sages who searched with their heart thought discovered the existence kinship in the non-existent. Transversely, was there severing line extended? What was above it then, and what below it? There were begetters. There were mighty forces, free action here and energy up yonder. Who verily knows, and who can here declare it, whence it was born, and whence comes this creation? The gods are later than this world's production. Who knows then whence it first came into being? He, the first origin of this creation, whether he formed it all or did not form it, whose eye controls this world in highest heaven, he verily knows it, or perhaps he knows it not. We see here in this rather interesting creation account that it is mostly questions. There are very, very few answers. In fact, the final result reached by the author of this material is that perhaps the one existent being knows what it was like when things were put together, or maybe he doesn't know. Maybe he can tell us, maybe he can't. A second ancient creation account we'd like to look at is perhaps the most famous of those that come to us from the Mesopotamian civilization, the so-called Enuma Elish creation account. This creation account is named Enuma Elish, that's its modern name, for the first two words of the account. The account comes to us on 7 tablets, still somewhat fragmented, although we have found some material to supplement the original find. And we'd like to give you a little synopsis of the Enuma Elish creation account. In the opening lines of the account, we find that there was a time when the heavens, the earth, etc., did not exist, but something did exist. There were two beings, Apsu and Tiamat. Apsu, a dragon of some sort, some people think represents salt water. Tiamat, another dragon, thought to represent fresh water. Apsu, male dragon, Tiamat female dragon. These dragons, we are told, create the gods. But after a while, they think better of it. Just as the parents have at time had children and then find that the parents cannot get their accustomed sleep because the children are always making noise. So in the Enuma Elish account, we find that after Apsu and Tiamat had created the gods made so much noise that Apsu could not sleep. So Apsu decided to destroy them. However, some of the gods learned about this in advance and beat him to the punch. And so Apsu is wiped out by one of the gods named Ea. Well, Apsu's mate Tiamat is furious about this turn of events, and she prepares herself an army of homemade monsters, gets together a couple of gods who are on her side, and decides to go and destroy the other gods. In tablet 4 of the creation account, we find that the gods appeal to one god, Marduk, who later becomes the chief god of Babylon, to defend them. Marduk says, yes, I will defend you if you will make me head god when this is all over. And the gods get together in a committee, and they decide that they will do this. They will make him chief god. And in addition to guarantee that he's going to win this battle so that they won't get wiped out, they give him special supernatural powers. He demonstrates these powers by making a cloak disappear and appear again. So after a good bit of talk back and forth and building up of the armies, the two come together in the struggle. Tiamat on the left and Marduk on the right. Marduk, using the wind, which is under his control, and arrows, manages to kill Tiamat and capture her army. At the end of Tablet 4, we learn that Tiamat, after having been killed, is split in half, sort of filleted like a fish, and apparently this fillet is used to form the heavens. Some scholars believe that half of the fillet is used to form the earth, but in fact the account does not mention that, and it sounds a little bit more likely that the salt waters below are to represent the dead Apsu, and the rain waters, which are fresh waters above, are to represent the dead Tiamat, so I'm inclined to think perhaps both halves of the fillet go up into the sky. Anyway, this is the situation. Marduk kills Tiamat, and Tiamat is split to form the heavens. In Tablet 5, of the account, we find that Marduk creates the stars, he creates the year, he creates the moon god, and at that point the rest of the tablet breaks off. We presume from later remarks that he must have created the sun god and such like. No reference is made to his creating the earth, so that must have been assumed to have already been there, something of that variety. When we pick up in Tablet 6, we gather that somewhere near the end of Tablet 5, the gods, after sitting down to enjoy what Marduk had won for them and to enjoy this sky and moon and sun and things of that sort which he had put together, found out that it was pretty hard doing all your own work, your cleaning and laundry and things of that sort, so that they called upon him to make them some worshippers who would also serve them. So Marduk, with the help of Ea, the guy who killing Apsu had gotten this whole thing started, they get together, they take the rebel god who had been on Tiamat's side, Kingu, and they take his blood and use that to make man. So man is made in Tablet 6 to serve the gods and to worship the gods, and that ends the creation account. Tablet 7 of the creation account is a eulogy to the god Marduk. So here we have a creation account that is filled with details, as opposed to that in the Hindu Vedic account we looked at, but such details. A third example of an ancient creation account is that in Genesis chapter 1, running actually through chapter 1 and into chapter 2. This account is different in many, many ways from the others. First of all, it gives information, and in that way differs from that in the Rig Veda. Secondly, it speaks of one eternal God. It puts the eternality, what exists in God, rather than putting it in chaos, something of that sort, as most scholars have felt that Apsu and Tiamat represent a chaotic water, or in this one being who is neither immortal or mortal, or doesn't seem to think, that we see in the Rig Veda account. So there is a one eternal God. It seems fairly clear from the biblical material that there's a beginning of the universe. not merely that stuff that has been sitting around for a long time is organized in some way, but that there is actually a beginning. This beginning is pictured as involving a construction in six orderly periods. Now, the activity of the God of the Bible in creation has been pictured on some hands in a rather anthropomorphic way, as we see here in Blake's engraving Ancient of Days, where we see God as an old man leaning down with a pair of dividers to put together the earth. And on the other hand, it has been pictured in a very non-anthropomorphic way, as we see here in Gustave Doré's engraving The Creation of Light. Quite a bit of variety among various persons on interpreting just what the details are in the biblical account, and whether God is to be pictured as a man of or a human being of some sort, or whether he is not. But the Bible does make quite definite statements, and God is claimed to be the source of matter and energy, and he's claimed to be the source of order and law, and as far as we can tell, the account in Genesis does not indicate a previously existing chaos. We'd like to turn now to look at modern cosmologies, having looked at these three representative ancient ones. Since these ancient times, there have been a number of advances in man's understanding of the universe from a scientific point of view, particularly. We'd like to sketch some of these advances, and then we'd like to have a look at what the situation is today, what the data looks like today in regard to the nature of the universe and its origin, and how these various ancient cosmologies fair in terms of what we do know today. After many centuries of neglect from ancient times, we have a renaissance in the 1300s and following, and just before 1500, a fellow named Nicholas Copernicus was born, who, among others, is responsible for rediscovering a number of things that the Greeks, or some of the Greeks, had apparently known about the nature of the earth and the sun and things of that variety, and even going somewhat beyond ideas that had been held at that time. Copernicus is known particularly for the one who saw that logically a far simpler model of the solar system could be constructed, in which the sun is the center of the solar system rather than the earth, which the orbits of the planets around the sun are circular. It turns out, actually, that his suggestion did not fit observations in its earliest form, as well as the highly refined theory at that point of the Ptolemaic universe, but it was a conceptual simplification and eventually was worked out by others to fit the data far better than this Ptolemaic theory that the Earth is in the center of the universe and the sun and moon and planets go around it. Quite important for observational matters in connection with the nature of the universe is Galileo. Around 1610, he was the first person to apply the then-recently discovered telescope to looking at objects beyond our own Earth. Here we see him with a chart of the moon showing the craters and the planet Jupiter with four of its moons, which he discovered, trying to convince a rather obviously not too easily convinced fellow that he should look through the telescope and see these things. Later in the same century, Johannes Kepler discovered the laws which describe the movements of the planets, that the planets moving around the sun are not well described by circles, as Copernicus had thought, but are better described as moving in ellipses, that the rate of their motion can be described as sweeping out equal areas and equal times, and he was also able to derive a relationship between the size of the orbit and the length of time it took for the planets to go around the orbit. His work was systematized and greatly simplified in certain directions by Isaac Newton, who was able to show that the fall of an apple to the ground and the motion of the Earth around the sun are actually both aspects of the same law of gravitation. So these theoretical foundations are certainly rather important in building up a physics which was able to begin to give descriptions of the heavenly bodies. A number of advances occurred in the area of equipment, but we will jump to the 20th century, where with the building of the 100-inch telescope that is on Mount Wilson, Edwin Hubble was able to show that certain blotches of light that had been known for a long time out in the sky were not merely masses of gas in our own galaxy, but were whole island universes, if you like, or what we now call galaxies out beyond our Milky Way. And this began then to open up to men the fact that the universe is a very large place, and that our sun is merely one of perhaps 100 billion stars in our Milky Way galaxy. And out beyond our Milky Way galaxies, there are at least billions of other galaxies. Since Hubble's time, more elaborate and more sophisticated observational equipment in the direction of telescopes have been built. Here we have some sketches of the Kitt Peak equipment. This particular instrument is not even as large a telescope as the one that Hubble used, although there are telescopes more than two times as large as that now in existence. But with very sophisticated guidance equipment, with far better film, with now a television-type method of strengthening the image, a number of other devices of this sort, even some devices now called rubber mirrors, where attempt is made to overcome atmospheric interference, far better work is being done in viewing the universe optically. However, it was discovered in this century that the visible radiation is not the only radiation that's out there in space, and in fact, some of the other radiation even reaches the Earth's surface. These things are called the windows because the Earth's atmosphere is rather clear to certain radiations. Over here is the optical window, and here at far longer wavelengths, the so-called radio window. So with the advent of rather elaborate radar equipment in World War II, technology was developed to be able to build rather large receivers in the radio range, which we now call radio telescopes. Here we have a picture of the Arecibo telescope operated by Cornell University. In addition, in parts of the frequency spectrum where radiation is absorbed before it reaches the surface, since 1957, with Sputnik and the American accomplishments limping in slowly behind it, but later catching up, we now have satellites which can get us above the Earth's atmosphere and look into various radiations that do not reach the surface. This is Skylab, one of the more recent of these observational satellites. Not only has observation improvements given us a great deal more data on which to base our models for the nature of the universe and whether it's got an origin or not and what sort of an origin it might be, but also our growing understanding in the area of the atom, the nucleus of the atom, has been rather important in this area. In this century, we've begun to see that there are forces within the atom, the strong and weak interactions, and that these forces do have something to do with the energy resources that are available to a star when it burns. Perhaps before this century, one could suggest that matter was eternal, that the universe could be rather static and have always existed, because no one had any idea how the energy was produced in a star. And although we knew that regular fire lit would burn down rather quickly, perhaps there's some source of energy in stars that would allow them to burn forever. Perhaps matter could last forever. But with our understanding of nuclear energy as it is developed in this century, we now begin to see that a star is using up its energy. It's using it at a very fast rate, but because it's using a nuclear fuel, it is able to get a lot of energy from relatively small amount of matter, and stars can last billions of years, but they don't last forever. And therefore, the stars that we see burning are one day going to burn down. And so you can't just imagine that those stars we see have always existed. Something has to be done to deal with this problem of the, if you would like to use a picturesque phrase, perhaps the decay of matter, that matter is decaying, that the universe at least would appear looked at simply to be running down. Well, that's got to be factored into modern cosmology in some way. Another feature that began to be observed as the large Mount Wilson telescope was turned on the galaxies was the so-called galactic redshift. As one looks at galaxies further and further away, we see here up at the top, galaxy in Virgo, another one in Ursa Major, another in Corona Borealis, and you can see the image gets smaller. So, of course, one could imagine perhaps that you're looking at bigger and smaller galaxies, but they're in groups that are with similar sorts of sizes. It looks like you're looking at further and further galaxies away. Now, when you pass this light through a spectroscope of some variety, presumably with the diffraction grating rather than just a glass prism, you get a spectrum of the particular galaxy. And we see these shown over here on the right side. The central streak in each of these spectrograms is the radiation from the object that's pictured on the left, and it has been spread out now over various frequencies. In these particular spectrum, we see a rather prominent double line. This line is an absorption line, calcium, and what we see here is that it is at different frequencies for the more distant galaxies. They are shifted toward the long radiation side, that is toward the red side, and this is called the red shift of the galaxies. The further galaxies you photograph, the further the shift is over towards the red side of the spectrum. Now, various proposals have been made for why the shift would occur, but the only proposal that has been made that fits known physics today is that these galaxies are moving away from us. If you've ever stood by a railroad crossing and watched a train approach and recede from you and listen to its whistle or horn or whatever it's got, you would probably notice that the horn sounds like it's got a higher pitch as it approaches you, and sounds like it's got a lower pitch as it goes away from you. If you thought of that in terms of the wavelength of the sound, it would appear to have a shorter wavelength as it approaches you, and a longer wavelength as it goes away. Well, it's suggested here that we have the light coming from these galaxies appears to be shifted towards longer wavelengths the further they are away, that apparently the galaxies are moving away from us at a more rapid rate the further they are away. So, two of the most important features of the universe that we have to contend with here, besides the fact that it's a very big place, that we're talking about billions of galaxies consisting of billions of stars apiece, is that matter has a tendency naturally to run itself down. If you have a lot of hydrogen gas, it will have a tendency under proper conditions to gravitationally pull itself together into a star. The star, when it gets a high enough temperature inside, will begin converting that hydrogen into helium, and then several stages later, as it moves on in its lifetime, will convert the helium into heavier elements until it would wind up with a cluster of materials around iron, which is the most stable of the elements, and then the star would burn out. There are a lot more complicated things that happen than that, but that's a very quick little sketch of the matter. So one thing would be the apparent non-eternality of any individual piece of matter in the sense of it being able to continue to glow, being able to continue to send out light so that you could observe it on Earth. I guess it would still stay around once it reaches the iron state, but you wouldn't know much about it. So that's a rather important feature that we'll have to deal with in modern cosmology. And the other would be the expansion of the universe, that the galaxies appear to be moving away from us and at more rapid speeds, more distant they are away from us. So this basically, the status as we come up perhaps to World War II or even shortly before it, that these two things were known, expansion of the universe and the tendency of matter to run down from hydrogen down towards the vicinity of iron. We then begin to get into various proposals that have been made for the nature of the universe. One early proposal, which is still around with us, was that of Georges Lemaître. Lemaître is the original proponent of the so-called Big Bang theory of the universe. He viewed the universe as having had a beginning, and that beginning was in a violent explosion. The universe exploded outward from a very contracted origin, and no new matter has been added to the universe, or let's say no new mass energy has been added to the universe since that time. The universe will therefore, if left alone, become more and more scattered. That is, the galaxies will get further and further and further apart, and the matter in them will form into stars. The stars will burn down, so that after a certain period of time, well, it would be quite a big period of time when you take the small stars into account, but after a certain period of time, you would eventually reach a place where you have nothing burning anymore. You have all of the stars are dead, and the universe would be a completely dark universe with the galaxies rather far apart. That was Georges Lemaître's proposal. I would guess, since he was Roman Catholic priest, that his proposal was probably influenced by his own theological views, which have some roots in the Bible. The idea that there was a beginning, that there had been no universe in existence before that time, seemed to go back to that sort of a picture. So The Big Bang is not held only in this particular form of Georges Lemaître. We shall see that in a bit. But basically the idea that there is a vast explosion from a very concentrated state, that you have largely radiation at that point, but as the universe cools down, you have the formation of galaxies. The galaxies disperse, as we see on the right, and eventually the galaxies would cease to glow. About the time of World War II, other modifications were made. This fellow, rather restfully sitting in the chair, is George Gamow, and he made a slight modification in Lemaître's cosmology. I do not know why, but basically his modification was such as to avoid a real creation. Lemaître had a creation at the time of the Big Bang, explosion coming out from the creation of material, and it's expanding beyond that. Gamow suggested that, in fact, the Big Bang was not an event associated with creation. In fact, it was a big bounce, if you like. That infinitely back in the past, you had basically had hydrogen gas very thinly diffused over the whole universe, and that's it. And that this gas was unstable towards contraction and gradually began to contract and contract and contract until finally, some billions of years ago, it had amassed itself into a very great concentration of material, and for some reason, it exploded at that point and began to bounce out from there. So we might call Gamow's theory a one-bounce Big Bang theory. There is one bounce in the history of the universe. That was a few billion years ago. There would only be life in the universe a few billion years this side of the bounce, and after you get too many more billion years this side of the bounce, so beyond where we are now, the stars would run down, and there would be nothing to support life, and that would be it. So we live in a very unusual part of the history of the universe. For an infinity before us, or before a few billion years ago, there was no life in the universe. And for an infinity after, some billions of years from now, there will be no life in the universe. But right now, we happen to be in the spot where there's life. Naturally, of course, we're life. But that's Gamow's view of the matter. The fellow who seems to be in a rather unsteady state standing over him is actually Fred Hoyle, one of the three proponents of the steady state theory of the universe. Shortly after World War II, Fred Hoyle, Thomas Gold here at Cornell, and Herman Bondi proposed an alternative model of the universe, which is called a steady state theory, or the steady state theory. The men did not have identical views on everything, but they were concerned that Gamow's view made this such a special time in the history of the universe, the one little short time of a few billion years in which there's life, with an infinity of billions of years in that direction, an infinity of billions of years in that direction with no life. They thought that was very unphilosophical, very unsatisfying. They proposed a universe which is infinitely large. Gamow's need not be, it could be, but need not be. They proposed the theory of a universe that's infinitely large, infinitely old, but always expanding, and always having matter only a few billion years old in it. Now, how do you manage all of that trick? Well, that's a little bit of a job, as a matter of fact. Basically, the idea is that for some reason, the space of the universe is always expanding in all directions. I don't know how to picture that exactly. I can give you a one-dimensional picture of it fairly nicely. You've been in an airport, perhaps, where they have these moving sidewalks, that you're carrying eight pieces of luggage and you don't know whether you'll make it to the terminal, and you see one of these, you step on it, and it carries you down without too much work the rest of the way. Well, imagine that you have two of these moving sidewalks going in opposite directions from one point, and a person can stand there and he puts luggage on each of the two moving sidewalks. And so a person standing up the road a ways on this sidewalk, just off the side of it, of course, and up this way, just off the side of it, will see one piece of luggage going by every 6 feet. And he'll see that all the time. And how can that be forever? Well, there's another guy putting luggage on down at where these things, two things start, and it keeps the spacing just right. Well, now try to expand that from one dimension to three dimensions, and you get a steady-state universe, except that I've left out one very serious complication, and that is you don't just have one guy putting on luggage at one spot. You've got an infinity of guys putting on luggage at an infinity of spots. The basic idea is that little hydrogen atoms, or perhaps little neutrons, are being created into existence by a natural process at a very slow rate. But at just the right rate, that the density of the universe remains constant at all times, even though the space is expanding and carrying these hydrogen atoms away from each other in all directions. These hydrogen atoms, when they get together, enough of them form a galaxy, and then inside of that form star clusters, and inside of that form stars, planets, etc. So that anywhere you are in space, you can always see some matter around you that's only a few billion years old, and is therefore still glowing. And if you get a big telescope and you look out in space in this direction, you'll always see some matter that's only a few billion years old and therefore still glowing. Look over that way, same thing. No matter how far out you look, no matter which direction you look, you will always see a universe that looks basically the same. This is what they call the perfect cosmological principle. The universe not only looks the same in all directions at one given time, but will look different at a different time, but it will basically look the same in all directions at all times. They felt that this was a very satisfying philosophical principle. It avoided having a beginning to a universe. It, of course, stuck them with a rather serious problem of having to postulate a law of creation that brought something into existence out of nothing. Hoyle has made some suggestions how this might be obviated by creating matter-antimatter pairs, that one goes into one universe and one goes into the other universe, things of that sort. But we won't get into that. Basically, a universe that is never changing in its general appearance. This universe does have the problem, as I say, that it violates conservation of energy, violates the increase of entropy locally, and many other of these principles. They said, well, it does it in such a small amount that it would not have been observed yet. So this is the so-called steady-state theory of the universe. It has no Big Bang in the past. Matter has never been more concentrated on the average in the past than it is right now. Never will be less concentrated in the future than it is right now. Since about 1950, however, this theory proposed about 48, evidence has gradually begun to accumulate, which may allow us to judge between the Big Bang type of cosmology on the one hand and the steady state type of cosmology on the other hand. One of these tests is to look at what the models would predict regarding the brightness of galaxies and the number of galaxies at various distances. If we were to plot galaxies, or here clusters of galaxies, on the one hand giving the brightness on the bottom here in the visual magnitude, and on the other hand giving their apparent recession velocity from us, the apparent redshift from us, then you get a bunch of dots running along a line like this, and all of the theories give you about the same distribution here on the low side. But as you go up towards the upper side, you can see in this diagram that the steady state theory begins to curve down from the cluster of the lines, and various other models run in a more straight through direction. So here we get into a big hassle of whether this particular observation favors or disfavors any of the particular models. If no corrections are made, this observation of the brightness of galaxies against their recession velocity already seems to disfavor the steady state. You can see the 3 or 4 points way up there at the upper right do not seem to lie along its line as well as upon the other line. Now, of course, the complication is that they're not sure they have made corrections for absorption over long distances in space, perhaps for change in the brightness of a galaxy over its lifetime, things of that variety. So a great deal of hassle has gone on back and forth since the 50s on whether this particular observation favors or disfavors any of the particular cosmologies. However, since the discovery of quasars early in the 60s, don't ask me to tell you exactly what a quasar is. Nobody knows exactly. But it's something that in a telescope looks like a star, but it's very far away. It's far too far away to be a single star. In fact, as you look at it, it's even bright for a galaxy, and in the radio range, it is pouring out an enormous amount of energy, now thought by some, at least, to be a very extreme type of large galaxy. Well, when you divide up the visible universe into 3 equal volumes, you would get a sphere centered around the Earth, and then a spherical shell, starting where the sphere ends and going out further, and then you would get another spherical shell outside of that. Well, it's hard to draw spherical shells in a diagram, so instead, pi wedges have been drawn in this diagram. The point part of this wedge going out to here, out to a redshift of 1.02, would represent a volume, let us say, one-third of the observable universe that is equal to the volume between 102 and 155, and another one that is equal to the volume between 155 and 203. Now, what they did was plot the quasi-stellar objects, or quasars, on this diagram, and they discovered a rather strange thing. It looks like that quasars are not uniformly distributed over these three equal volumes of the universe. The inner one has only got two quasars, and they're not the brightest kind of quasars, they're only the bright kind of quasars. There aren't any dim quasars, it's kind of like toothpaste. You have large, super, dynamic, jumbo, etc., tubes of toothpaste, but you don't have small tubes of toothpaste. Well, quasars come in two sizes, bright and very bright. And inside this volume closest to us, there are only two quasars, they're only the bright kind. There are certainly no more. Now, by certainly, we mean it's conceivable one could be hiding behind a galaxy somewhere, something of that sort. But they're bright enough that you couldn't miss them. In this second region, there are four bright quasars, and one very bright quasar. You're far enough away now that a bright quasar might be dim enough not to see it. So there might be more than four of those, but you're not so far enough away that you could possibly miss a very bright quasar. There's no more than one of those, that region. In the last region, there are five very bright quasars, and you're so far away you couldn't see a bright quasar if you tried, and you might even miss some very bright quasars, so there might be some more of those. Now, if we come back to the proposals of these theories, this does not fit the perfect cosmological principle which underlays the steady-state theory of the universe. In that model, the universe ought to look the same, look at a large enough volume, ought to look the same in all directions, and ought to look the same at all times. Now, in fact, when you're looking at this volume of space, you're not looking at the same time period as when you're looking at this volume of space. And when you're looking at this volume out here, you're not looking at the same time as when you're looking at this space, because light takes a finite time to travel. It travels about, as I learned it in junior high, 186,000 miles per second. I think that's 300,000 kilometers per second. So it takes about a year to travel 6 trillion miles. And we're looking at distances out here that we're getting up around many millions of light years, even up towards a billion light years, if we get the outer range. So you're looking back far into the past here, and 2 times, maybe a little more, 2.5 times further back for the average in the middle of this region, and a little more than 3 times for the average in the next region. It looks like the universe was more crowded with quasars in the past than it now is. Both of these cosmologies, both steady state and the Big Bang, have assumed that we're not happen to be in the middle of a universe that's more crowded toward the outer edge at any given time, but that we're actually looking back into the past on this. So the situation seems to be that the observation of quasi-stellar objects does not fit the steady state theory of the universe. Does not changing with time, that is always got a certain density, but rather points towards a universe that was more dense in the past. There's a third observation which seems to bear somewhat on the matter of choosing cosmology, and this involves the fact that when you look at the universe with a radio telescope, the sky is gray rather than being black, let us say. That's the simplest way to put it. When you look at the sky with an optical telescope, the sky is basically black unless it's clouded over in the sodium vapor lights from Ithaca are shining down your telescope or whatever. But ignoring that, getting out somewhere on top of a high mountain where you're above a good bit of the atmosphere and that sort of thing, the sky looks basically black with all these stars pinpointed through it. Doesn't look that way with a radio telescope. Radio telescope, it looks kind of gray in all directions. And that surprised a number of people when that became apparent, and fiddle around with the instruments for a while to make sure it's not just instrument noise and things of that sort, but you have this irreducible noise which seems to be well above the noise level of your instrument. You're able to get your noise level of the instruments way down below it, and you've got a remaining noise from the sky, a radio noise. Not intelligent radio broadcast as far as we can tell, but rather some sort of electromagnetic radiation in the radio range. Now, it just happens that the Big Bang theory of the universe had already predicted there would be something of this sort. The proponents of this theory had predicted that the explosion that made up the Big Bang of the universe would have been a very high temperature radiation. But as the universe expanded out from this, the temperature of this radiation would go down very rapidly and would have gotten down in the vicinity of 3 degrees or so by this time. They'd already made that proposal before these observations were made. Whereas the steady-state theory of the universe and other models had not any reason to suppose there would be something of the sort, and usually have had to scrounge around some to find something that might somehow, in their theory, give you an observation of this sort. So here was something that the grayness of the sky came quite naturally out of the Big Bang theory and did not arise naturally from the steady-state theory. This, then, as Schatzman points out in his book, The Structure of the Universe, the observations, when you put them together of this grayness in the sky at different frequencies, turn out to fit rather well a 3-degree black body curve. So the present state of the matter is that the Big Bang theory, in its various forms, naturally predicts the appearance of this radiation and predicts it being this size, and the other theories did not predict it. But the result of that was that a number of the proponents of the steady-state universe have abandoned their position, some to move on to other varieties that are different from the Big Bang, and others to stick with the Big Bang. In 1965, it was when Fred Hoyle switched his theory, and it was considered sufficiently earth-shaking to make the Syracuse Herald American, which is not exactly the astrophysical journal. We see here the report as it's given there. You have to realize that newspaper articles usually don't tell you too much about what's actually happened, but he said he had probably been wrong for about 20 years on the nature of the universe, and then goes on to describe briefly what Hoyle had done. Hoyle, as a matter of fact, does not really move over to a Big Bang universe. He remains with the steady-state universe, but he's changed the ground rules a little bit. He now says that we are an expanding bubble, if you like, of a steady-state universe, and there would be contracting bubbles at other places, and that we'll probably never be able to build big enough telescopes to observe outside of our bubble to show that it really is a steady-state universe. It's going to look like a Big Bang universe, even though it really isn't. Newsweek, in commenting on this, points out that although his theory is rather dramatic, it violates one of Hoyle's own rules, that theory should be kept simple and free of untestable ingredients. Hoyle's new theory reminds me somewhat of a character in Alice in Wonderland, the White Knight. He mentions, as he's talking to Alice, "I was thinking of a plan to dye one's whiskers green, but always use so large a fan that they could not be seen." Basically, the picture here of a proposal of how things really are, but it's set up in such a way that there's no way to test it whatever. Always beyond test. Hoyle has pointed out that he does not like Big Bang type theories. We tend to think of scientists, at least scientists often would like us to think of them this way, as those who are really searching for the truth, and nothing will turn them aside, etc. I suppose in every profession, they're sort of the ideal of what people are supposed to be like, but in fact, we're never very much like that ideal. So Hoyle here, in his work, Nuclei, Galaxies, and Quasars, in which he first proposes his new model of the universe, says, "Speaking personally now, I have a strong emotional dislike for special setups in cosmology. I can see that the oscillating cosmology, that's a variety of the Big Bang we haven't discussed yet, might have been initially set up to give the observed a symmetry of time, but any suggestion of initial tinkering being necessary to explain the most everyday features of our existence seems intensely distasteful to me. It implies the universe is a poor sort of thing, only capable of lumbering along as a working concern if special adjustments are made, like the old car I used to run in the immediate post-war years. The idea I use in cosmological investigations," he says, "is that all important aspects of the universe are contained within the laws. They are not impressed from outside the laws. This is one of the shortcuts I use. I personally spend no time investigating theories that require special initial conditions." Hoyle is basically saying that he has emotional preference. That is allows him to set up a shortcut. He does not examine certain types of cosmologies. He is going to examine a cosmology in which the only eternal thing is a law structure, or so I would gather from this remark here. The only eternal thing is a law structure. Many people have not been satisfied with the idea that merely a law structure will describe the universe as it now stands. Einstein himself, for instance, did not feel that the orderliness of the universe could be so easily dismissed as merely being a law structure. Einstein points out that to him, one of the most incomprehensible things about the world is that it is comprehensible. What do you mean by that? He means that here's the human mind, which according to many moderns, is a product merely of trial and error in a random process occurring over some years, and yet somehow that mind that has been developed by this random process is capable of understanding things it has never had any interaction with. Calculus, galaxies, quasars, all of these things. The thing that Einstein felt to be so strange was that the mind of man was somehow made that it fit into the universe to a certain extent, far beyond what you would expect from the kind of experiences you would imagine cavemen would have had, clunking each other on the head with clubs and things of that variety. So the suggestion then is order merely explained as some impersonal law, or does it look like that there is a interlocking of design in the universe that makes sense of a human mind is able to understand this order? That's a problem which Carl Sagan grapples with in his book, The Dragon of Eden, tries to speak of the idea of a resonance of some sort. There's a resonance between the human mind and the universe. Or the ape men who thought of the universe as a complicated place didn't survive, whereas those who thought of it as a simple place did survive. But I find both of those explanations rather heavy going. They don't seem to explain what's really there. After all, the universe is a pretty complicated place. Why is it that the laws of motion and such are sufficiently such that men can do something with them in their minds and that sort of thing? Why do we see such very tightly fit structures within life that have led some people to say, as I remember a physicist said looking at a trilobite eye, that looks like that was designed by a physicist. Well, as Schatzman points out then in his remark, The Structure of the Universe, the present status of the original form of the steady-state theory is that it's been abandoned. It's probably fair to say that by now the steady-state theory, at least in its original form, has been abandoned by almost all its authorities. It was an attractive and plausible idea, but it did not fit the facts. And like many other attractive theories, it has had to be given up. It does not mean that the Big Bang idea is necessarily correct, but it does mean that the universe is in some sort of state of evolution. Some sort of state of change is a characteristic of the way the universe seems to be behaving. Well, having wandered then through the realms of the steady state theory for this long, let's take a look at the varieties that exist and what the various implications are of these different varieties of the Big Bang. All the varieties of the Big Bang have an explosion of some variety, and now the date for this explosion has usually been postulated around 15 to 20 billion years ago. As this explosion cools down with the expansion of the universe, you begin to get your gases forming, and these eventually break up into blobs that form galaxies, and within those blobs that form star clusters and stars and such. So let's have a look then at the types of the Big Bang theory. Mathematically, there are various ways to divide up Big Bang theories, and one can make somewhat more complicated models if you propose that there is some sort of repulsive force in the universe that flings these things apart, things of that variety. But we'll be working here with the simplest model of the Big Bang, a variety in which a repulsive force is not brought in. This was the original version which Einstein had kind of wanted to have, and then because the universe had to be static, he put this repulsive force in to make it static, and then he found out a few years later from Hubble and such that the universe was really expanding, and with great relief he threw out the repulsive force. But people keep trying to bring it in now and then. You get basically three types of universes, a so-called open universe, in which the universe from its explosion, the Big Bang, will expand forever, and would correspond roughly mathematically to the hyperbola group of the conic sections. Then you get a critical type, which would expand forever, but it slows up slower and slower and slower as you go out further and further, so that in infinity it would go to a static state, and that's the so-called critical form. And then you get a so-called closed form, in which the universe, after expanding for many billions of years, gets slower and slower and slower, finally reaches a maximum expansion, and now it begins coming all back together again. These would be the three varieties mathematically in the simplest form of the Big Bang theory. However, we can make a slightly different division, which I think is more significant philosophically, and that would correspond to a question of bringing in what happens before T0, what happens back in this direction with the open or the critical form. And this would then divide us up into three forms again, since we're going to lump the open and critical together as being not observationally basically any different. You would have, on the one hand, Lemaître's no-bounce Big Bang. The universe came into existence in connection with the Big Bang. There was a creation and has been expanding since that time. Then you would have a one-bounce Big Bang, such as George Gamow would propose, either an open or a critical universe, which was very thinly spread out hydrogen gas infinitely in the past, pulls itself together under a gravitational instability, bounces once, or the Big Bang is a bounce then, rather than just a bang, it's a bang too, of course, and goes off forever in the other direction. And then the natural situation with this closed universe would be that there are an infinity of these bounces, all the same size, going off in either direction, what we call an oscillating Big Bang theory. So those would be the three more significant divisions, I think, from a philosophical point of view. No-bounce Big Bang, originally proposed by Georges Lemaître. A one-bounce Big Bang is proposed by George Gamow. And a oscillating Big Bang, I believe Ernst Erpich was responsible for that. He's at least written on the subject. So let's have a look then at these three. Can we make any selection among them observationally? Well, as Schatzman points out in his Structure of the Universe, there is one problem that may very well crop up with an oscillating Big Bang theory, the variety Erpich. Erpich's thing, notice you have an advantage in a sense with Erpich's. You have presumably life during part of the expansion of the universe every bounce. So you don't have to propose that our particular time is an unusual time in the history of the universe particularly. It's a kind of a period of time that occurs maybe 25% of the time throughout the whole history, infinity to infinity. New set of people or whatever each time, but something of that variety. So that's felt to be better philosophically by many people than a one-bounce universe. However, the problem that you get into is a question, can you get around entropy with this particular kind of universe? Can you have a situation where the bounce will be the same height all the time? If the bounce is not the same height, then an infinity of time, the bounce will either damp out and you have nothing. You have a universe sitting there crunched together in its Big Bang form, or spread out in its spread form or something of that sort and doing nothing. Or the bounces will get bigger and bigger and it will run away with you. You'll get, after an infinity of time, you'll get infinitely large bounces. So why are we here or something? So the problem is infinity is a long time. That's what you really get down to. You have to propose in this model that there are no irreversible effects that accumulate in this theory, or you're going to run yourself into serious problems. That means you've got to propose in some way that every time you go through the crunch, all of the radiation that has been radiated out by all the stars in their lifetime during the previous expansion and contraction somehow gets crunched back into just the right stuff to form down into the right same number of galaxies and such, to radiate off the same amount again and bring it back. If you don't, you either get an accumulation that you wind up with all radiation, or you get accumulation you wind up with all matter, something of that variety. So that's the sort of thing that Schatzman here is proposing as a problem for the oscillating universe. Now, Robert Dickey at Princeton University points out there's another serious problem that not only applies the oscillating universe, but also applies to Gamow's one-bounce universe, and that's the bounce. With the known physical situation, is there any reason to believe that a contracting universe will stop contracting and start bouncing again once you begin to get very high densities? Well, Dickey's whole project of studying the cosmic black body radiation was intended to work in this direction, and their discovery of the black body radiation complicated the whole thing. It was known mathematically that the equations, which give you the bounces that we had and that sort of thing, that the equations can't be integrated through the collapse of the universe to show the start of a new bounce, that you actually have mathematical singularity at that point. It had been thought, as he says, that the singularity was due to the over-idealized nature of the physical assumptions. We've made a simple universe. We haven't worried about the stars and all these sort of things. We've just kind of stuck the matter out there and calculated densities and things. It was hoped the singularity would disappear if you put enough irregularity back into the mathematical model. But as Dickey points out, this has not occurred. And the situation at the present point is that a contracting universe would kind of pull itself into a big black hole, and that would be it. It wouldn't come back out again. So here you've got your universe contracting, and it goes shwoop, or whatever sort of noise it makes when it does it, and you haven't got a universe anymore. And where's the next bounce? So that, as you can see, could foul up. It's kind of like bouncing a ball on the pavement and goes down a mole hole or something. You can't get it back. Well, that seems to be the sort of problem. So as far as present knowledge goes, the universe doesn't look like it would bounce. There's a further problem with the oscillating cosmology, and that's the so-called closure question, here discussed in a little article in Science News. Is the universe open or closed? Will expansion someday stop in reverse, or will it continue forever? This is perhaps the number one question in cosmology, certainly the biggest. Well, that's a little too much PR, I would say, but and it has been endlessly debated, well, not more than 50 years, but because the answer depends upon things that cannot be seen. All estimates of the amount of visible matter in the universe agree that there's not enough to close the universe. We're talking about. Well, we know how fast the stuff seems to be expanding away. If you don't have enough matter, gravity won't stop it from expanding. It'll keep expanding. Well, you can't very well have an oscillating universe if it just keeps getting further and further apart and never turns around and comes back. Well, the visible amount of matter in the universe certainly is not enough to cause the universe to turn around and start contracting. Now, the problem of closure has not been settled as of yet, but a further step was taken just this past year, April 15th, a flight to look at one of the quasars in the ultraviolet, and this observation suggested that there was no detectable neutral hydrogen gas in the intergalactic medium between the Earth and the quasar. That is to say, in looking at the light coming from that quasar to us, that passed through a lot of space. They could not detect neutral hydrogen line in this material coming through, which suggests that there is a definite upper limit to the amount of neutral hydrogen between us and that quasar, quite small enough that you are nowhere near having enough dispersed matter in the universe, or neutral hydrogen, something like that, to make the universe pull itself back together with the rate of expansion that is presently going on. So it indicates that there is not enough dispersed matter in the universe to cause the universe to stop expanding and start contracting. There leaves, as far as I can see, there may be some other arcane possibilities, but it seems to be only one of the possibilities, and that is there might be some concentrated matter in the form of black holes or something here and there. There might be enough of that to cause the universe to stop expanding and start contracting. But we're really down to about that one last alternative as a possibility. The evidence so far suggests that the universe, as its expansion, is not going to stop and start contracting again, which means that the oscillating cosmology has really some very serious problems with it. So if we look at the cosmologies we've been discussing this evening, the steady state theory with a natural continual creation has an infinitely old universe, an infinitely large universe. The universe allegedly looks the same in all directions in its original form. Seems to be rather definitely disproved. One can move back to a steady state universe where the steadiness of the universe is forever beyond the range of our observations. but that is at least a problematical way of proceeding. The oscillating Big Bang does not have a creation. The universe has always existed. It has bounced in and out, rather like an accordion, except in three dimensions. And so infinitely old, there's no creation. Universe could be infinitely large, might be finite, make a big deal one way or the other. This particular model faces a problem that one would expect that certain irreversible effects would accumulate. That would seem to be a problem. One would expect that from observations there's not enough matter to make the universe stop expanding once you get it expanding, and one has some very serious theoretical problems with stopping the thing from contracting once it starts contracting. So a number of rather serious points against it. The one-bounce Big Bang, because it does not have to stop expanding and come back, does not have to hassle with irreversible effects accumulating and does not have to hassle with the question of the closure of the universe. On those points, it agrees with observation, but has a very serious problem that no physical laws are known which will stop a contraction and start an expansion. The actual existence of black holes would seem to suggest that gravity kind of wins the fight when you get the stuff closely enough packed together, no matter what the other forces are. So the one-bounce Big Bang really has some serious problems. The only model, among simple models anyway, which seems to fit the observed data, is a no-bounce Big Bang, that the universe hasn't bounced. It had a Big Bang. We still have the radiation left over from that. It's expanding from that, but that the universe did not have a history before that time. Only the no-bounce Big Bang fits the presently known data without postulating undiscovered laws to get around problematical data. Now, of course, we haven't discovered all laws that exist. I think it's fair to say that. But on the other hand, there's no reason to assume that when you discover laws, they're necessarily going to be just the ones to bail you out so that your pet theory works either. So you have to keep both of those things, one in each hand, if you like, whenever you're investigating theories. So this is basically the situation with modern cosmology at the present time. Now, the striking thing about this is that the no-bounce Big Bang itself comes from a fellow who rather obviously was familiar with the Genesis material and apparently believed it, and which resembles the Genesis material in this rather important point, that it does have a beginning and it postulates a creation that brought about this beginning. So Genesis 1:1, with its statement of a real origin of the universe, was model for the no-bounce Big Bang, or alternatively, Genesis 1:1 fits the known date of cosmology better, now this is an interesting thing, better than the oscillating Big Bang theory, which is actually the theory that is preferred by most cosmologists today for metaphysical reasons. Because they feel it's unkosher, if you like, forgive me if there are any kosher people out there, not according to Hoyle, to allow the supernatural, something of that sort, bad. That was accidental, I believe. To invoke, sounds like you're drawing a circle on the ground and lighting candles, to invoke the supernatural, but one must always assume that a natural explanation is going to work, they don't prefer a cosmology with a real creation in it. But even though that may be taken by many people to be a basic assumption of science, I don't think it's necessary to science. There are certainly many of the people in modern science, Newton's time certainly, believed in the existence of the supernatural. But since many people feel that so, they have very strong reservation against accepting any kind of a creationistic cosmology. But you've got to realize that the assumption of the non-miraculous in order to do research is a ground rule of some variety, and there's no reason why the universe should cooperate. The universe either does have a supernatural connected with it or it doesn't. If it does, it doesn't do any good to invent methodologies that are going to rule it out. That will be just like taking Hoyle's shortcut if, in fact, the universe isn't the kind of universe he's looking for. A shortcut should be designed to get to the right destination quicker, but if you shortcut the right destination, you won't get there. So this is the rather strange situation we have today. A evangelical philosopher and theologian, James Oliver Buswell, in his Systematic Theology, points out that it is this idea of absolute creation that is one of the most distinctive doctrines of biblical Christianity. He points out that when you look through the ancient cosmologies, and we only look through three of them, there are hundreds of them, in all non-biblical sources, the doctrine of creation out of nothing cannot be found. The doctrine is not only totally absent, but previously existing material is referred to. Within the Judeo-Christian tradition, the doctrine of creation of nothing has been taken as granted in the doctrine of the Bible since long before the apostolic times. If this doctrine is not found in the Bible, has been proposed by many liberal theologians, how did it originate in human culture? What is the source of the notion? Certain it is that Bible-believing people down through the centuries understood the Bible as teaching that God created the universe by sheer act of his will, causing that to exist which had not previously existed in any form whatsoever. The point that Buswell is making here is that the idea of a real beginning in which there was nothing but God before, and then you get a universe, is unique to the Judeo-Christian materials, with the fact that there are, of course, then some thinkers at later times have been influenced by it. So here we have this rather puzzling feature of these ancient cosmologies. There is one which does point to a real beginning, does give a suggestion for the origin of order in our universe and design in our universe and for why the human mind might be able to understand such design. That is, that there was a designer. He put these things together. He did start at a real beginning before which what we see around us did not exist. And then the strange thing we find today is, in fact, that fits the observations of cosmology better than the cosmology preferred by most cosmologists. A very strange turn of affairs. Why is it, we may ask, that the Bible, written so many centuries ago, before the age of all of our scientific apparatus, fits the modern data? And why is it that cosmologists, and let's not blame just the cosmologists, along with so many others, do not like the idea of a beginning in any such absolute sense? The Bible has a suggestion why that's so. Also, mentioned in the letter which the Apostle Paul wrote to the Romans, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, it's rather interesting, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. The Bible, in a sense, answers these two questions. Why is it that the Bible, written so many centuries ago, before the age of all our scientific apparatus, fits the modern data? Answer, the Bible is a communication from the one who put it all together. He ought to know what it was like. He ought to have known that when he did it, and thousands of years after he did it, and thousands of years ago, as well as he knows it today. So the fact that we're just finding it out shouldn't be any barrier to him communicating it thousands of years ago. And why is it that cosmologists, along with so many others, do not like the idea of a beginning in any such absolute sense? That's seen here in the same passage as well. The answer is, man is in rebellion against his creator. We do not want to admit his existence, or at least we do not want to admit that he has real claims to our obedience and to our devotion. We do not want somebody else telling us what we ought to be doing. That is, if anything, a characterization of our whole society since the Renaissance, but it's a characterization of our society since long before the Renaissance. The characterization of man, as far back as I've known anything about him, as I've read anything about him, a desire of man to either be his own God or to make his own God, rather than to let the one that exists be who he is and we be in the right relationship to him. Well, that's all I've got to say this evening, but I will try to field any questions if I can.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania. Zip code 19440.